Hello and welcome. This is Open Air, and I'm Renee Kemp, your guest host today, sitting in for David LaTulipe. Such a pleasure to take a break from the news of the day and instead explore some of the lively art scene here in the Bay Area. Today we talk to Nicholas Kanalakis. He's a featured performer for Music at Menlo. And of course, Music at Menlo is celebrating. Once again, we're not talking news today, no suffering, just fun. Music at Menlo has been around for
sometimes.
It's so true. You suffer for music, right?
Yeah.
That's Nicholas Kanalakis, and he is a cellist extraordinaire, and he's performing at Music at Menlo. It's the annual Chamber Music Festival, and they and their institute are celebrating 16 seasons of brilliant performances and premier masterclasses as well. Plus, today, the Bay Area Playwrights Festival is winding up this weekend, and we'll have a conversation with playwright and emerging talent T.D. Mitchell, along with director Eric Pearson and festival artistic director Amy Mueller. It turns out that this year, appropriately enough, resistance and revolution are on the menu for this year's plays, and the performances, all of them actually delve into the most pressing issues of our times, and there is a fantastic array of styles this year, too. So we're looking forward to talking about this year's festival. Also, John Banbury and Nancy Zappi star in the San Francisco Playhouse version of Sundays in the Park with George, where literally a painting is brought to life. And finally, we chat with the man known as the Bard of the Lower Haight, Clyde Always. Clyde, as always, will be offering his blend of vaudevillian music and humor, and he'll talk to us about his eponymous performance of the Clyde Always Show. And as a real treat, he brought Haley, the ukulele, along. So we're looking forward to today's show. Let's start with Nicholas Kanalakis, the cellist extraordinaire performing at Music at Menlo. Nicholas is hailed by The New Yorker as a superb young soloist. He's become one of the most sought after and one of the most innovative cellists of his generation. Nicholas Kanalakis recently made his Carnegie Hall Concerto performing debut, and he performed with the American Symphony Orchestra in the Isaac Stern Auditorium. He's an artist of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, with which he performs regularly in Alice Tully Hall, as well as on tour. He's also a regular guest artist at many of the world's leading music festivals, including Santa Fe, La Jolla, Music at Menlo, of course, Ravinia, Bridgehampton, Mecklenburg, Hong Kong, Moab, and Saratoga Springs. It's really extraordinary to see you after hearing your music. You look too young to be able to perform kind of music. It seems like you should have had to live a bit longer.
I appreciate that.
It's remarkable. It's just remarkable. You really are an extraordinary cellist. So let's start by talking about your relationship with Music at Menlo.
Sure. Well, it actually goes back a few years now, because I first came to Music at Menlo in 2006, when I think it was maybe just the third or fourth year of the festival. I was a student. You know, a big part of Music at Menlo, aside from the great performances that they put on with, you know, international touring musicians, is this educational component where they have students of many different ages. They have as young as sometimes 11, and then they have conservatory-level students. So I was there in 2006 as a conservatory student, and that was, I think I'd met David Finkel and Wu Han, the artistic directors, maybe once or twice before, but that was when I really got to know them through that festival, and I learned so much. And then I came back as a sort of artist about 6 years later. And then I've been here many times since then. So it's really nice, because I feel like I'm kind of part of the homegrown spirit of the festival.
Well, there, when you were there in 2006, you were sort of a prodigy among prodigies. Is that an overstatement?
I refuse to use that word to refer to myself. I can't say prodigy, sorry, but I appreciate it. But I just finished my studies at the Curtis Institute of Music. And so I was at that kind of difficult, awkward time of post-school, but not quite fully having a professional career yet. And that's a scary place to be in many ways for any musician. So it was a great opportunity to come here.
And this particular performance has connections with cities around the world, including London, Paris, St. Petersburg, Leipzig, Berlin, Budapest, and Vienna. Do you have any personal connections with those cities that you bring to the performances?
You know, I mean, I've been to many of those cities. I don't know if how much actually being in those cities necessarily informs my performance of the music. You know, to me, the music kind of speaks for itself, and I think it's what's interesting is to understand the history behind it, to where these pieces, what circumstances a lot of this music was written in. So in that way, I suppose it does inform it, but it's hard to sort of pinpoint. Well, you know, oh yeah, I went to Vienna that one summer, and so I'm going to play, you know, Mozart differently. I'm not sure it quite works like that.
But you do make it a point to look at the history of when that piece of music was written, and how does that inform your performance?
You know, it's interesting to know. To try to know a little bit about what the composer's life was like, and what his personality was, and what heartbreak and tragedy he experienced, and to know, you know, for example, if you know, a lot of pieces, if a work was written during World War I or World War II, that, you know, of course would have affected it. Or so the more you know about the composer, then the more you know about what was going on in the world, or at least in the composer's world at the time that they wrote a piece, the better I think you can understand where the piece is coming from.
Let's talk a bit about Transfigured Night for String Sextet by Arnold Schoenberg. Why is this a seminal piece in the performances?
Yeah. Well, Schoenberg was such an important composer that went through such, maybe more than just by any other composer, such a transformation of style. Speaking of Transfigured Night, I mean, he started in the deeply entrenched in the late Romantic era, influenced by Brahms and Wagner, and ended up writing the most atonal, 12-tone music. He really was a composer who believed that he was going to be of a generation that completely changed music, and he did. Of course, it's not necessarily that the style of 12-tone music has lasted up to this day, but so the Verklärtenacht, the Transfigured Night, is from his early days, when he was really writing in an extremely romantic spirit. But what's interesting is that you hear a kind of foreboding of his later styles come into this romantic style. So you hear these sections that are strange and have notes that seem out of place, and that's really him foreshadowing his later styles, where he gets into much more atonal writing.
You talked about the atonal quality, and hopefully we'll get that queued up in a second. Sure. By atonal, it was meant to be a little disturbing. It was meant to upset people. It was deliberate. Why?
Definitely.
Why was that, and what do you do to kind of make sure that upsetting quality is incorporated in the performance?
Yeah. I mean, well, that speaks to a couple of... It's a great question. I mean, two things. I think historically, composers like Strauss and Schoenberg, I think that they believed that that tonal music had reached the extent of what it can do, that there's nothing left for it. Every tonal note had been written, and it's time to explore, to push music further than that. But I think you're right. I think at the end of the day, what composers traditionally used dissonance, or, you know, atonal music for, was to create disturbances in the music, because music is not there just to sound beautiful. It's supposed to express a wide range of emotions, not just happiness and beauty, but fear and something unsettling and shocking sometimes. And I think that's where dissonance, or in taking dissonance to the extreme, which is having an entire piece of dissonance, which is what atonal music is. Yeah, it does come from the idea of unsettling the listener.
And now's not a bad time in history to kind of shake people up a little bit.
Definitely.
Do you bring any contemporary thinking to this kind of music?
I'm not sure. I think just any great music, any great art is that's sort of the point in a day like we live in today, that there's still there's still that in the world, the great art to hold on to when all the craziness is happening around us.
I often wonder, I've never asked, do you dare depart from the way it's written? Do you dare add or subtract?
Yeah.
Or do you feel compelled to stay with it just as it's
yeah.
written?
Another great question. I mean, in terms of that, that's sort of the question that we have as musicians in our daily lives whenever we interpret a piece of music. You know, I think you want to have two things all the time. One, maybe firstly, is to be true to the composer's intention. But you don't want to be a robot to it. You want to, the composers wrote this music to be played by human beings and to be played differently mm-hmm. depending on who's playing it. So you have to put your personality into it in some way. And I think in the ideal world, there's a way to do both where you don't sacrifice the composer's intention, but you enhance it by giving it your own kind of individual spin on it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Nicholas Kanellakis, featured cellist at Music at Menlo. And you're playing in two different concert programs, Budapest on July 31st, Vienna on August 2nd and August 4th. So which concert or concert piece do you feel like you're looking forward to most?
Both. I mean, I'm playing three really great works. They gave me some good repertoire here. One is the Kodály Duo, which is a Hungarian composer, Zoltán Kodály, great virtuoso piece for violin and cello. Then this great sextet by Schoenberg. And then we're closing the whole season with Brahms's famous piano quintet in F minor. And pairing Brahms and Schoenberg together, always their kindred spirits.
And what's next for you as a cellist? Are there more festivals this summer?
Yeah, summer is always a busy time for festivals. So I'll be going to a number of places here in Northern California, another festival, Moab, Utah. I was just in Colorado. I was just in St. Petersburg. So it's a busy time.
It's such a pleasure to meet you and to put the person behind the music. It's been a treat to talk to you, Nicholas Kanellakis, featured cellist at Music at Menlo. And we do have the Brahms Quintet to play you out with. So
great.
Thanks again, Nicholas Kanellakis.
Thanks.
Welcome back to Open Air. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in today for David LaTulippe. And next up, we talk about the 2018 repertoire at the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. It runs through this Sunday, July 29th, at the Potrero Stage in San Francisco. And this year's festival features Resistance and Revolution. Could it come at a better time? Bottom line, art may be our salvation. When the news is so dire and so bizarre, it might be that playwrights and poets and comedians and musicians and spoken word artists are the way that we deal with what's happening. And today, from the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, we have Amy Mueller. I was so excited because it's interesting to kind of go behind the scenes and talk about the making of the art. And as artistic director, Amy Mueller is an award-winning director and producer for original theater for over 30 years, and she's a leader in the national new play development sector. So much of the new performances are based on what's happening in contemporary art and in contemporary news. So it's fascinating to have her talk about what it's been like since taking the helm of the Playwrights Foundation in 2001. Amy Mueller has transformed the scope of that organization into a national center for playwrights, and she focused on developing new work for the American stage through discovering and supporting contemporary playwrights. So, Amy Mueller, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Yes, indeed. We also have Eric Pearson. He is a director based here in the Bay Area, and he's also a projection designer. His recent projects include John Glover's new opera, Lucy, for Urban Arias in D.C. He's a guest lecturer at the Yale School of Drama and a guest artist at Rutgers University. Eric is a member of Wingspace Design Collective and holds a master's in fine art and directing from the Yale School of Drama. Eric Pearson, director, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And lastly, T.D. Mitchell is the playwright. This literally is her baby. It's called Virtual. And she's got many credits, including A Gray Matter, previous plays, include In Dog Years, Madam Red, The Crowd. She's contributed a short play to Imagine Yemen, which premiered at Signature Theater in New York back in June, and her essays for Verbal Supply Company and speech writing for international philanthropic organizations and magazine articles are just examples of the kind of multi-format, cross-genre work that she does. But today she's here to talk about her performance of Virtual. And I'm going to get started with you, T.D. Mitchell. Talk about your play, Virtual. What inspired it?
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, indeed.
Virtual is the third in a series of plays, preceded by Beyond the 17th Parallel and Queens for a Year, all dealing with the military culture and veterans issues specifically. But Virtual is a big stylistic departure for me in that it's absurdist, it's a dark comedy, whereas my two previous works were very clearly anchored in traditional American narrative drama, realistic, naturalistic style drama. The world around me seems to be turned upside down quite a bit, and to me, the only way to write the next play was to jump into that fully, that upside downness.
So preview that now. Are there things that are actually upside down on the stage, or how does that manifest?
Well, I wanted to explore the tension between live dramatic action and our attraction to two-dimensional stimuli, to screens, and see what happens when we put live action story up there, but we also have visual messages, audio messages. It's really a multimedia experience. I would say it's less that things are upside down in terms of staging, as they are a bit inside out and back and forth in time. There are walls around worlds that I create in order to break them. So we're in one reality, or we think we're in one reality, and then another time, another reality imposes itself on that one, breaks the pattern, and disorients us, as our lead character is likewise disoriented in his own process and experience.
So this is on purpose. When people experience this, you want them to be disconcerted.
Indeed, yes.
It's interesting because I know that you also have to probably think about the extent to which this plays right into the fact that people multitask now. You're on your cell phone, you're on the computer, you're driving. So to what extent does your approach here play into the fact that people have gotten accustomed to having a lot of stimuli all at once?
A great deal of it is comes from that change in us culturally and behaviorally. That this play is my chance to explore that and to, instead of fighting against the disruption of screens, see if I couldn't harness it, manipulate it, and use it to tell a story in a different way.
Let's talk now to Eric Pearson. He's the Bay Area-based director for Virtual. Can you talk about, just based, Eric, on what she was describing here, how do you harness all that and not overwhelm an audience? How did you even begin to stage something like this?
That's a great question. I mean, we've been using projections in the theater since the Magic Lantern shows of the late 19th century, and there's always been a tension between the two-dimensional projected imagery and the very live and real and present human beings on stage. And so much of the work as a projection designer is often figuring out how to throw focus back to the human beings and not upstage them with the large, moving, bright imagery, potentially dwarfing them upstage. And in this case, it's really a joy to be working on a production in which the imagery is so integrated and essential to the storytelling, not just the form, but the subject. I've been on in New York for the last 10 years, and this is my first project having returned to the Bay Area. And one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is, as this community is changing in San Francisco, for better or for worse, how do you make theater for the tech community? And so taking on this project here has been particularly meaningful, especially as we wrestle with how tech companies are complicit in the ways the various military misadventures that the American government is participating in. So it's a very special project to be working on here and now.
And TD's work is very original. I mean, it's one of kind. How do you approach something that is unprecedented, literally?
That's a great question. Traditionally, in a workshop environment, you would really shy away from integrating lights and sound and costumes and staging, much less projections, to really give the playwright an opportunity to hear her words with the actors and evaluate what's working and what might need some more development. But in this case, it was so clear that for her to do the work necessary to continue to develop her play, that we would need to begin to experiment with some of these projections. In one case, it literally is a character in the scene. And so we worked to balance the work integrating some of this projected imagery with the continued work for the actors. But it's been a unique and very exciting challenge.
I have to wonder how much of what we will end up seeing is your input, and how much of it is T.D. Mitchell saying, no, this is how I imagined it in my head, and it's got to be that way. Did you have that kind of tension?
I wouldn't describe it as tension. I would describe it as
tension in a good way.
Yeah, sure. Collaboration.
Very artistic good collaboration.
Tension.
Very yeah. good collaboration. Yeah, I knew pretty quickly in my first conversation with Eric that he was the right director to collaborate with on this, because he respected the fact that the way I've written visual information into the script is extremely specific. But there is still room for experimental style and execution and visual design, and that having someone who speaks that language of visual design and of projection has been invaluable for me in this process as I rewrite.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. It winds up this weekend, and we're having a conversation with the playwright and emerging talent, T.D. Mitchell. and the director of her performance of Virtual, Eric Pearson. And we hear next from Festival Artistic Director Amy Mueller. Amy, how many submissions do you get every year, people looking to be included in that very short list of people who get to see their things come to life? And just describe the process.
Sure. Well, this year we got over 700 submissions.
Wow.
We have 80 to 100 national readers, a pool of people that we recruit. And the plays, each of the 700 plays had two readers. And so each of those readers submit an evaluation of the piece based on some of the things that we asked them to look at. They are ranked. And then we at the Playwrights Foundation, the artistic team and the literary team take a look at all of that, and we're able to hone down the plays to approximately 140 scripts from the 700. And those plays are then read by our literary council at Playwrights Foundation, which is a group of about 15 people. They're all professionals in the theater, dramaturgs, artistic directors, directors, some playwrights, some actors. There's a very wide group range of voices at the table. And we're then read all of those plays a third time and have several meetings to sort of hone it down.
Was 700 an unusually large number?
It was about a third larger than the previous year.
That's extraordinary. Were you surprised?
I was surprised, yeah.
Were there any similarities in the submissions that you got?
I get that question a lot. Mm-hmm. you know, no. I mean, yes and no. I mean, at times, when you're reading that many plays, sometimes you're reading sort of doppelganger plays, you know, mm-hmm. plays that in another life would be the other play. You know, that they're plays that tackle the same terrain or the same situations, but from a, you know, a different vantage point. But they're essentially the same play. If you were to, you wouldn't put them on the same festival together. This year, there were quite a number of plays that address the politics, American politics, the political system. But honestly, there are almost always those plays. And it almost always reflects whatever is, you know, going on in our political world. So, I would say there were quite a number of plays about the experience of immigrants in various countries, and there were quite a number of historical pieces. And I thought that was very interesting, simply because I think playwrights right now are sort of looking at history to try to understand the present.
Can you identify what it was about T.D. Mitchell's Virtual that grabbed the attention? What was it that made you select her?
Well, first and foremost, we're looking at the voice of the writer. And as you very cogently put, T.D. has an absolutely singular voice. And this play in particular, we've worked with T.D. in the past. T.D.'s an alumni playwright. This particular play tackled an extremely important social issue, not just because it's about the military, but also because it's about the impact of our communication system on our psyches, and how that's playing out. And I think that's a really important concept for all of us to be grappling with for ourselves individually, you know. And so there was that, but it wasn't just the subject matter. It really was her dramaturgical skill, the way that she approached the material. It's a non-naturalistic piece, meaning that it it doesn't occur in real life, IRL. It's not sort of us sitting down talking together in this real time way. Mm-hmm. That it sort of scans between memory and experiences that aren't 100% in real life. They're virtual. They take place in virtual reality. And this individual who happens to have been a soldier, a military personnel, is really struggling to decipher which of his memories are IRL in real life and which were part of his training in virtual reality and his recruitment, and really struggling with that. And I find that to be a very fascinating question.
The Bay Area Playwrights Festival was founded in 1976, and the foundation is recognized worldwide, actually, as an incubator of sorts. And T.D. Mitchell, you, as Amy said, you came through, and you've been in past performances. So what's it like to mount virtual your play in 2018, having come through the program over the years?
Well, it's great to be back. I was back here with an earlier draft of my previous veterans play, Queens for a Year, about five generations of female Marines. Mm. And I find from the foundation, from Amy, an incredibly supportive team and an environment in which I can really do the difficult work. I have that support that I can take big risks, and maybe they're going to fail spectacularly, but then I'll go back to an earlier draft and try something else. But this is my chance to do it, because the playwright's work tends to be extremely solitary, usually about 2 years worth of solitary before anyone else gets to play with it. And this is definitely an ideal environment and organization in which to do that play.
As we wind up, Eric Pearson, you're the director. What do you hope people walk away from this performance?
I mean, I suppose this project, as well as most other meaningful works of art, I hope they walk away with a lot of questions and go off to a bar and wrestle with some friends about how what they just saw relates to their life and the world around them.
And go off to a big full production somewhere with a lot of funding.
Absolutely.
And aren't the best plays the ones that you can't wait for the après play coffee or cocktail, where you want to talk about it? You can't just go home. You have to talk about it. So that's what you're hoping, and I'm hoping that for you. So congratulations on having your work brought to life. T.D. Mitchell, the playwright for virtual and artistic director for the Bay Area Festival, and Eric Pearson, the director of virtual. Thank you all three for being here. Good luck with the performances.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes, indeed. They actually wind up this weekend. So if you can, make sure that you get there. It's at the Potrero stage through this Sunday. Welcome back. This is Open Air. I'm Renee Kemp, your guest host, sitting in for David LaTulipe. And next up, we talk to actors John Bamberry and Nancy Zappe. They play the leads in the San Francisco Playhouse production of the musical Sunday in the Park with George. If it's familiar, it's because it's a real classic, a Stephen Sondheim musical, and it is running now through September the 8th. It's unusual in so many ways, but mostly because it literally has a painting that comes to life. And we're going to talk about the production and the challenges of bringing this classic to life. First, we're talking with John Bamberry. He plays George, and he says he's thrilled to be spending his summer at the Playhouse. His credits include A Midsummer Night's Dream with the Shakespeare Theater Company. Actually, a great deal of his repertoire is in Shakespeare Theater. He's also a featured soloist at Boston Symphony Hall and at Carnegie Hall. John Bamberry is a graduate of the Boston Conservatory at Berkeley, the Moscow Art Theater School, and the Juilliard School. So, John Bamberry, or should I say George, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
And Nancy Zappe, she plays Dot in the play. She also plays Marie. Nancy Zappe trained at Circle in the Square Theater School in Manhattan. She has performed at the Playhouse in the roles of Ilona in She Loves Me, Alora and Carla in City of Angels, and Belinda in Noises Off. Her New York credits include Cat in One Good Day, Rita in Uncommon Women and Others. Nancy received a San Francisco Bay Area Critics Circle Award in 2017. Nancy Zappe, Dot, and Marie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us, Renee.
Yes, indeed. Let's talk about the play itself. The musical itself is based on a well-known painting, and my guess is that there's only so much you can do with stage design when you're literally framed in this painting. So let's start with you, John. Mm-hmm. How do you stage that, and what does the audience see as it's being played out?
I like to be able to step out of the frame, particularly because George is the artist, and I'd read somewhere that the genesis of this piece was James Lapine, who wrote the book, saying to Sondheim, or they were standing in front of this painting, and it was very curious to them, and I think it was James Lapine who said, it's because it's missing the subject, which is the artist. So in that sense, when you're standing in front of the painting in the Chicago Institute of Art, you're taking the role of the artist, or at least the perspective, so you get to see... He puts you into his shoes. And because of that, I think there's a responsibility when you're doing the play to be able to step out and really take sides and take hands with the audience. Because of that, you have to be super receptive and responsible for how they're seeing or what they're seeing at any time and how they're receiving it and how they're breathing. You know, all of that you have to be very sensitive to. With any play that's live, that's what's so great about live theater, is that you're receptive to breath as opposed to like film or television, which is just like you do it and, you know, hopefully people get it, you know, but it's great to, you know.
Well, you also have the job of playing, was it pointillistic? Painting, which is taking little small pieces of color and forming it into one work.
Yeah.
So, I don't know whether that kind of goes into your thinking about how to play a character or
totally.
Not.
Yes, yes, very so? Much so. It also, more so, it's a bit of the tail wagging the dog in that situation, because James Lapine wrote the book very much in keeping with that. If you look at the scenes, they're very episodic. They're pointillist in that sense that they don't flow from one to another like a regularly structured play. They kind of begin and end and are next to each other, but don't always necessarily move one into the other. And because that just is the structure of the play, it forces you to get into that mindset when you're working on it. You know, I mean, I suppose you could ignore it, but at your own peril. You know, it's like that's the structure of the play. Figure out how to how to do this, you know.
Figure it out, right? Yeah. Nancy Zoppi, let's talk about your role. You play Dot, which is George's girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
yes?
Yes, correct.
And, and it's from a play, from a painting, rather, called A Sunday Afternoon on the Isle of La Grande Jatte.
Correct.
Okay. Make that accessible, if you would. Talk about what does that look like when you breathe life into it and make it three-dimensional on a stage?
Well, you know, I'm a kind of actor where I always feel like a pitcher of water, and all of these choices we have, and the play is often like a table. And if you just pour the pitcher of water down onto the table, it's going to go everywhere. But if you have a glass on that table that you can pour this water into, I think there's a lot of freedom and beauty into that. And I feel like you talked earlier about how this show is going off of a painting, and there are specific things you have to do in this show. You have to have these actors at this particular point. You have the quintessential empty glass in this show, which is actually really lovely to me, and figuring out how to fill that out and make it more human is a really nice project as an actor that I've really, really appreciated. So to take this two-dimensional piece and make it three-dimensional, I had a goal of just making Dot, George's lover, as human and everyday as possible. I think people respond to different things in art, one of which is these people you never really get to see and aren't really like you, and look at what you can learn from these people who aren't like you, which I think is wonderful. And then there's another way of learning and enjoying a show, which is, look at this person. I have parts of myself in this person. And I think if you can achieve that, you can bring people in and flesh out at two-dimensional into a three-dimensional.
So give us a synopsis of the play from beginning, middle, and resolution.
Yes. So the beginning of the show, we come into George and Dot really have the first beginning of the scene. Well, it begins with George, and then Dot enters in, and it's slowly you see all the people in the painting come in, and you get to see parts of their lives as imagined by Lapine and Sondheim. The basic story of it is, to me, is this artist and what it means to be an artist and to have a relationship and how that works. So you follow these two people and their ability or inability sometimes to connect, and you go through the course of the middle of the relationship to the end. That's the first act. And then we go into the second act, which is about 98 years later from the end of the last scene in the first act. And now George and Dot's daughter is 98, and her grandson, George Surratt's great-grandson, is now an artist in 1984 and dealing with perhaps not the same struggles as George the First, but the struggles of the artists in the 80s and maybe modern-day America. And it takes us through that and what it means to be an artist and what it means to try to create something new. And what, if new even exists, other than it coming from a singular person and being their voice being heard throughout the world.
And I know that you play both Dot and Marie.
I do.
Talk about Marie's character.
Well, Marie, I think, is she's very, as I like her, very quirky. I feel like she is Dot without the problems of being born in France, being born female, being born lower class in the 1800s. And she now has been able to have a nice, rich, full life and gets to, I think she's kind of the device to tell George what maybe Dot always wanted to be able to communicate to him.
And John, you play both characters, Seurat's fictional great-grandson,
mm-hmm.
George, right?
Mm-hmm.
So challenging to play both?
Yeah, I mean, they have their different relationships to art, and they have their different challenges. Particularly, I think it's about the framing of how the evolution of what it means to make art for a living, actually.
Mm.
And that second act sort of comes about right when, like, the Andy Warhol factory years would have been, and Julian Schnabel was a great influence to me. And even now we've got, who's the Obey artist? You know who I'm talking about?
I do, but I can't think of the name.
There's an interesting dichotomy of, you know, when you think about art history, you think like, okay, well, there was a certain time where people were not even signing their names to art. It was sort of all made for the church. It was all made in glorification of either like, even caveman paintings, like, here's what it is to be a man. It doesn't matter that I did it, but here's what my experience was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the same time, it's like, here's the glorification of God. And then something started to shift and happen where it became this ego-driven thing, and we're almost into this this thing where it's almost more important who's making the art than what the art is actually saying. And I think that's the point that Lapine and Sondheim were sort of pointing at, is that, you know, Seurat was maybe sort of somewhere in between there, where he was still just trying to get what he was saying out there more than himself. And now we've sort of flipped the script on it a bit, and you've got, you know, there are people who have entire artists who have entire factories of interns doing their work for them, you know, and they kind of just like give them marching orders, and then, you know, they have the idea, I suppose. So I think that that's a bit what it's about.
Well, you certainly have big shoes to fill. Sondheim, yeah. That kind of art, I'm sure, feels kind of big. Not to mention that your roles were originated on Broadway by Bernadette Peters and Mandy Patinkin.
Mm. Yes.
And, yeah, and plus you've got this sort of abstract thing about art, and we all know the angst of the artist and lopping off ears. And I mean, you know, the whole idea of trying to deal with the idea of art must just be very, very challenging. So,
You
like that?
I like to get away from that, honestly. I think that makes it less accessible.
Mm.
I've been really obsessed with this book on flow, which is it's a psychological phenomenon whereby you're at sort of like the beginning. You're pressed up against your capabilities as a person. This is studied in athletes and musicians and, you know, people at the higher end of all of their professions. And it's – you're reaching towards something that you're not sure you're capable of. You've never done it before, but it's challenging everything you've done up until then. And it's really, you know, getting you to do that. And I don't know. I think that that's I think that that's more accessible. That's something than more so than the like, oh, this artist, he's highfalutin. We can't really relate to that because we're not artists in the audience. Like, I guess that's what it must be. I like to try to keep it a little more down to earth of like, no. This is somebody who must do what he must do because it's challenging him in a way that no other aspect of his life is.
And I think that's what the brilliance of Sondheim is, too, to kind of delve into that.
Agreed.
We've been talking to actors John Bamberry and Nancy Zappi, who play the leads in the San Francisco Playhouse production of the musical Sunday in the Park with George. It runs through September 8th. And as we thank you and say goodbye, we're going to hear just a small sample of you guys singing your roles. Again, John Bamberry, Nancy Zappi, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Design, composition, tone, form, symmetry, balance. More red, and a little more red. Blue, 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 even, even, good. Bum, 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 bum. More red. More blue. More beer. More light. Color and light. There's only color and light.
If you're just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Open Air, and what you were just hearing was just a snippet of John Banbury and Nancy Zappi's performance in Sundays in the Park with George, currently at the San Francisco Playhouse through September the 8th. And now the part of the show I've been looking forward to, because, okay, it's Clyde Always. And they don't call him the Bard of the Hate for of the Lower Hate, right? For
nothing. Lower Hate, yeah.
The Lower Hate. Gotta be the Lower Hate,
well,
right?
Well, yeah. I'm no
Clyde
upper
Always.
Hate bard, no.
He's an all-American tall talesman. He calls himself a dime-a-rhyme vaudevillian,
mm-hmm.
and he's been providing audiences here in San Francisco and around the world with just the amount of laughter that we need, just a splash of laughter and some comfort and some joy, and boy, do we need that now. So thank you so much, Clyde Always, for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here in the studio with you guys. I've never been in a studio like this before. This is pretty nice.
Well, you also brought Haley, the ukulele.
I certainly did. Yeah, she goes everywhere with me, actually. She's my lovely wife.
We're going to hear from her later, yes?
Maybe a little snippet, yeah. Sure.
I hope so. Let's talk a little bit. I just looked at your website, and just looking at the website kind of raises a lot of questions.
Okay.
Clyde, okay. So,
fire away.
First of all, it's ClydeAlways.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go there, folks, you'll see, for instance, something called Smutty Bupkis.
Yeah.
Talk about Smutty Bupkis.
Smutty Bupkis was my latest chapbook, you could call it, or a zine, you know. So it's a kind of a Xeroxed masterpiece that I clickety-clacked on Loyal Royal, my typewriter, which I got at a yard sale for $20 a couple of years back. And it contains such Clyde Always masterpieces as the tale of Stella and the Frat Boy and Bloodbath, which is it's a doozy. Yeah, if you can handle a little bit of gore, but don't worry, it all comes out clean in the end.
Uh-huh.
So I write them, I illustrate them, I go down to Copy Central and I print them out and I sell them for $5 a pop, and I'll write you a little personalized autograph if you buy one.
Well, it's hard to even know where to catch this thing to start talking to you, but
yeah, sure.
Talk to me about how you became the Bard of the Lower Hate. Let's go back to that.
Okay. Well, it started back in 2012 when I had never performed anything before in my life, and I wandered down the hill to Cafe International, which is a swell cafe on the corner of Haight and Fillmore, and there was a whole bunch of guys, and they all had acoustic guitars, and I said, "Hey, guys, what's going on?" And they said, "It's an open mic night, and anybody can do whatever they want up there." So I scrawled a few words down on a piece of paper, and I got up positively quaking, and I thought my heart was going to burst out of my chest, and I was going to drop dead right there, but I didn't. I recited something, and nobody listened to me, and I went home, and I said, "What do I got to do to make these people listen to me?" And I started talking to myself in the mirror, and before long, it popped out. I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, come on, and step right up, folks. Come on and grab yourself a front row seat before they're gone, and they're going fast. You don't want to miss this. It's time for another exciting installment of the Clyde Always Show." So all I'm trying to say is that it's something that came down from above, and I couldn't stop it. And when you are the Bard of the Lower Hate, you don't choose that. It chooses you, and that's the way it is, and that's how it's been. And I go out on the town, and there's inspiration everywhere. Everybody's got a story. Maybe I think you got a story. I think that, yeah, we've all
well,
got
we
one
all
to
do,
tell.
But
oh, yeah.
Not everybody's as interesting as yours, I must say.
No,
like,
yeah.
How do you become a vaudevillian in the 2000s? How does that happen?
I'm just an old-fashioned kind of a guy, and I see, you know, and I mean, I'm as guilty as anybody else, but everybody's got their neck craned down into this little screen, and they're watching BuzzFeed or whatever, like, dribble there is just to occupy and draw your mind away from what you really should be doing, which is listening to the universe, because the universe is talking to us all, because there's an artist, there's a creative type in every single one of us. Are we doing good for time? Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that's what I wanted to do, is I wanted to make a throwback to what we all used to be doing, going out and watching live performances, or spending our time crocheting scarves, or
did you crochet that?
No, my mommy crocheted it. Thanks, Mom. I hope she's listening. Yeah.
Talk about the Marsh.
Oh, the Marsh. Yeah. So it's so funny too, because I kind of manifested this whole solo show idea. This was last year. I was looking through an old thing and I saw my little doodles for what the set would look like and my ideas. And I contacted the Marsh and said, I've got this swell, one man show. And they said, okay, come on in, do a one night only performance. And I sold out the theater that night and I got a standing O, and it was probably the best moment of my life. And, Stephanie, the owner of the Marsh, Stephanie Wiseman, thank you, Stephanie, if you're listening. She was so, taken aback by my show because it's so unlike anything else that's going on in the world of solo performance, that she said, I think we need to give this guy a run. And so now I'm 3 weeks into my run at the Marsh. It's every Wednesday for the next 5 weeks now. And I'm presenting the entire repertoire of all my stories, poems, verses, songs, small tales, tall tales, etc. And I built some really swell props, and I've got a really great light board operator named Aaron Aguilar, and he's got the cues. What's more, I've incorporated my illustrations and my paintings into the set, and there's dramatic reveals, veils dropping off, and
wow,
cutouts flying in the air. Yeah, it's pretty intense. So
what a rush!
Okay, yeah,
to get to good. Yes. I mean, when they said yes, it must have been just amazing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's a big deal. I felt like, you know, it was the next logical step in my development. So.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes left, and I can't let you go without hearing from Haley the ukulele. Do you mind?
Yeah, sure. Well, here, this is really all you, Haley sings is a little segue, but can I regale you with a small story?
Sure.
Before we go?
While you play, go for it.
The Tale of Tucker and the Toast. Once upon a time, in the Marina District of the charmingest little city there ever was, there lived a swashbuckling pirate named Tucker. Now, Tucker had a three-cornered pirate hat, and he had an eye patch, and he had a big, bushy pirate beard, and he had two peg legs, and his timbers perpetually shivered. Now, Tucker had plundered plenty of riches over the years, what with the gold, the rubies, the Spanish doubloons, but he found the most desirable of booty to be expensive brunch items. Oh, he wasn't content to swill grog like the rest of the pirates. No, his poison was a finely crafted Bloody Mary with organic pickled sea beans. What's more, rumor had it that he had hoarded away more than $1 million worth of eggs, Benedicts, and he buried this treasure out somewhere beneath 22nd Avenue. Now it so happens that one sweltering Sunday afternoon, Tuckery'd set sail for the poppinest restaurant in the whole neighborhood, and suffice it to say, neglected to make any reservations. In fact, immediately upon arrival, he hoisted the skull and crossbones up over the flawlessly landscaped St. Tibble patio, and he called out into the sea of terrified diners. He said, "Avast, ye swabs, our throats I'll slash. Your grub be mine for taking." I guess that's all the time we got. If you want to hear the whole story, you're going to have to come. I'm sorry we ran out of time. That
it's
was
okay.
Fault.
Actually, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. between now and August 29th, you can hear more of Clyde Always. I know I'm coming.
You're coming?
It is so... I am.
Right.
It is so... quintessentially San Francisco. Ladies and gentlemen, Clyde Always and Haley the ukulele is going to play us out. And until next time, when David LaTulipe will be back, this is Open Air. I'm Renee Kemp. Next week on Open Air, regular host David LaTulipe will be back, and he'll be talking with the West Edge Opera Summer Festival and artistic director Jeffrey Thomas. Also, contributor Peter Robinson comes back. So next week, join us. We'll be back. Thank you again, Clyde, always, for playing us out.
Thank you, Renee. Good night.